we left off in Genesis chapter 1, as you may recall, but we're getting close to the end of that chapter, so I think there's momentum in our favor now. We left off with verse 26, which says, "Then God said, let us make mankind in our image and our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." If I was a little more on about my craft, I would now tell two or three jokes to warm up the crowd. Can I just tell you how delightful it is to be the preacher in a community where I don't feel compelled to do that? I really don't, so I'm just going to get right into it. Thank you for humoring that inclination. We left off considering some of what might be evoked by the "let us" language in the verse, and the key idea that we touched on there was the idea that the "us" is royal us, royal we, kind of language, the language of kingship, and that the emphasis in the text is on us as humans as co-rulers over all that's made, which is why the verse uses that kind of language, so that they may rule over. And I said that we were going to pick up on some of the implications and the possible misapplications of that text before we move on a bit more into the story and what it tells us about what it truly means to be humans that are made in the image of God. If you've studied history any amount, especially the history of the Western world, of our cultural world, then it wouldn't be unusual along the way in those studies to have encountered some fairly aggressive assertions that Christendom is responsible for the mess in which the planet currently finds itself. And I'm not going to try to retrace the key arguments around that this morning. I'm not an historian, and there's many of them. So there's two good reasons for me to not take that on. But from my vantage point in a postmodern, post-Christian West, I am going to say that I think there's some merit to that critique. But I also want to suggest that the aggression or the single-mindedness with which that critique is sometimes brought into the dialogue might not be in proportion to what has actually transpired historically. There might be a bit of a rebalancing that could be done there. And I'm not going to spend a ton of time on it, but I think it's an essential point of consideration, if only because of the dominance of that particular viewpoint in the academic conversation, the one that just says over and over again, this is the core reason for the mess. And it can get out of balance. A little more context from Genesis for this. So if we keep going from verse 26, it reads like this. "So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God he created them, male and female he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." When Corrine and I were starting our family, having kids was not a no-brainer for us. Now, that might seem a little bit strange now, considering that we have four and that we homeschool, which for some people is synonymous with overzealous, overprotective, fundamentalist, family above all, you know, kinds of families. I am happy to explain to anyone that really cares why we made that choice, but I'm not going to burden you with an explanation of that this morning. But our discussion about whether or not to have children of our own, to form, if you want, a relatively traditional kind of nuclear family, had a great deal to do with this text. The text, I think, there's lots of ways to read it, but one legitimate reading, I think, is that we can understand it as God's initial directive to the human race about how to live out what it means to be uniquely human in the world. Kind of an initial charge or an initial sending sort of a conversation. If it helps you to picture it, if we're thinking in terms of the language of kingship and rulership, it is, in a different cultural setting, one from the past, it is the king calling the subjects into the throne room and saying, I'm going to give you your marching orders. I'm going to tell you how, from the king's vantage point, this ought to go. And that's sort of what that text is. God blessed them and said to them, and then we have this charge. be fruitful, and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. And the question that that text raised for Corrine and I in this conversation about family was taken from a very literal reading of the text. And the question that it raised for us was, isn't the earth already full? When's it full? If the marching orders for humanity are to fill the earth, what does it look like in our imagination? What does it look like in our everyday life when we walk back into the throne room and we say, done, next? Because the numbers are crazy. Maybe it's full. And if it is, then what might caring for the humans that already filled the place look like? With so many kids on the planet that don't have access to a home in the terms of shelter, food, all the things at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, you know? Never mind a family that loves them, that nurtures them, that's able to provide for their needs. Given the number of children that don't know that, maybe that's our job. If it's full. Well, I'm not going to unpack our whole process around our final decision either. Partly because, as anyone who's ever had one of those conversations can tell you, there can be quite a complex matrix of factors in how you actually arrive at the final decision. And the realm of the discussion is deeply personal to boot. But apparently, to sum up, we thought there was room on the planet for at least four more. I'm also not telling the story to suggest that there's no other conclusion that we could have reached. Because I know way too many families whose mandate to love and nurture others has taken shapes very different than the shape of our family. And I have witnessed and experienced richly those shapes as being shapes that are full of beauty and full of truth, full of creativity. They're full of the presence of God in the world. I would never want to suggest that there's only one way forward into this thing that we call family. I think we live in an age where that's going to just be more and more obvious that that's the case. Rather, I tell that story to open up the sorts of questions that I think are quite naturally raised by the text. We need to raise those kind of questions. This is the kind of work, people, that the Genesis story compels us to do. Fill the earth and subdue it. Well, what if it's already full? Is a significant question. It's a kind of question that shapes the way we imagine what it's like to live well in the world as humans. It's not the kind of question that feeds into one right answer only sorts of living. It's the kind of question that feeds into creative co-rulership over everything that was made, which is the marching orders that the king gives to the subjects in the story. Not doing this kind of work leads to disaster, which I think brings us quite tidily back to the problem with what has historically been made of these verses. If you take fill and subdue and you literally and liberally apply it to the human enterprise, what you get in no small part is what we now have. Those four kids that Corrine and I brought into the world and love, they have got one hell of a mess to deal with. And as a dad, I try to, in an age-appropriate way, be pretty frank with them about this stuff. I don't want my children to live disheartened, overwhelmed lives. I also don't want them to be naive about their inheritance. And I don't want them, as part of their not being naive, I don't want them to be oblivious to the way that the faith story in which they are being raised contributed to that mess. That said, I also want them to live with hope and vivid, as well as actable, imagination about how that same faith story can richly inform a life of creative nurturance of all that was made, because that's possible too. If we misunderstand fill and subdue, it renders the statement, just because we can doesn't mean we should, irrelevant. And the way that that works is all the concrete, literal reader of the text has to do to play the God's command trumps all card, all that reader has to do is point to this text that we just read and say something like, well, you can give it whatever kind of wishy-washy reading you want. I say that it commands us from God that we should subdue all creation. That's our job on the planet. It says so right here. Full stop. And it is important, I think, when we encounter that kind of thinking or that kind of reading of this text, to consider where that kind of reading has taken us to. And then to ask if the place where it has taken us to is consistent with a wider understanding of the character and nature of the Christian God. How does acting out of that understanding of the text, what does acting out of that kind of understanding of the text produce? What has it produced? If we stay on that trajectory, what might it likely produce? It's important, I think, when we're doing this kind of work, to note of our own sacred text that it does not say certain things. It does not say that it's our job in the world to destroy, plunder, pillage, and rape the environment. That's not, in fact, it's not even implicit in subdue. We'll get to that. It does not give us carte blanche as co-rulers to do whatever we want, to take whatever we want for our own advancement of wealth, of profit, for our own personal, corporate, or national interests. But those are all ways that this text has been twisted to justify self-serving behavior. Now, how we respond to a text like this is rooted, deeply rooted, in what we understand it to mean that we're co-rulers with God over all of creation. And it might help us to reconsider, as part of trying to imagine that, what God's own practice of kingship behaves like, right from the beginning of the story. See, the reason we have stories, like the big story that we're exploring, the reason that so much of the big story that we're exploring is imaginative text, is creative text, in this case poetry, rather than a rule book, is because this text, in our hands and in our lives, needs to be able to operate with vigor at any point in history, under any circumstance, in any culture. It's easy to lose sight of this as Western Christians or people who've grown up under Western Christian influence, because it's been implicit at the zenith of modernity and Christendom in the West that the reading we're giving to this imaginative story is the only possible reading. If that's true, then the end of the story is almost foregone at this point. If the trajectory that we have imagined from this text is one we continue on, then practical observation of the world around us, never mind the science of what's going on with the planet, makes it pretty clear where we're headed. If there is no other way to imagine what it means to subdue as co-rulers in a way that is consistent with the rulership of God's self, then I'm with the folks who just want to make the earth mother and cuddle up with her. Because our story is not going to carry this forward in ways that are healing. Now, I think the good news is that that kind of reading and being locked into it is not necessary. And it's not implicit in the big story. It's just the particular reading that's been made of it by industrial humanity in the Western world at the zenith of modernity with the results we live with. I hope that wasn't too many qualifiers. Anyway, let's keep going, because this idea of how God behaves as a king is really interesting. And it's there right from the beginning of the story, right? In the beginning, God. That's the part of the story we're in when we're in Genesis. And in the beginning, God, as we noted right from the start of the tale, the way that God behaves as a king in the world is with dominion, which is an interesting idea. Dominion is very different than domination. Dominion, as an historic idea, is a far, far richer one. And we won't take the time for this, but we live in a dominion, which can kind of help us to imagine what governance looks like when it's dominion rather than domination. Most of us have never had to live under a despot. We have never had to live under a dictator. You know what the most efficient form of governance is? Dictatorship. You want to get stuff done? Go live in a dictatorship and be the dictator. You'll get things done. It's super efficient. Is it the best form of governance? Well, I think that even the near evidence of history would suggest that there's some problems with most dictatorships, not the least of which is the singular locus of power. So if you got a bad dictator, you got a bad scene for everybody, right? You could argue, and we're gonna just park this after this idea, but you could argue that the best form of governance is a benevolent dictatorship. Anyway, you can just take that home for lunch, chew on it. God is a king. The reason I mention it is because you can make that argument about the idea of God, right? Benevolent dictatorship. Okay, I said I'd keep going. Right from the beginning of the story, we have God behaving in the story as a king in a way that is dominion but not domination. And that's a reason for the shape of the story. That's one of the reasons why right in this first chapter of Genesis, we have a story that unfolds, sort of leaf by leaf, frame by frame, whatever picture you want to use. We talked about time-lapse photography. That's why the story has the shape that it has. That's why the story starts out with nothing, a void. You go sit down with a blank piece of paper and a pen and try to find a word for nothing. You know, it starts out with just... And then, from nothing, something. From nothing, to dark, to light. From empty space to space that's occupied with something vague and then something more fully formed. And then occupied with the kind of things that we recognize as things. Sky, land, light, dark, creatures, us. So the story just unfolds, if you want, if you want to call nothing general to human specific, it just, the details just keep coming. It's an unfolding story. Who's unfolding it? In the beginning, God. So this is the way our sacred text gives us the story. And this is why God involves us as humanity in the story the way that God does, as co-creators. Because as we have this picture of God in Genesis, God is the kind of king, not that operates as a dictator or despot, but the kind of king that evokes and that draws out and that collaborates. And as we keep going into the story, we find out that that collaboration from the beginning for us as humanity is an incredibly rich, incredibly engaged one. And we'll come to this as we keep going. But even the unfolding of the ideas of language, of naming, of trying to find ways to give things understandable significance. These are tasks that, as the sophistication of this story kind of keeps layering up, that God hands to humanity. It's fascinating. Instead of powering up over creation, as we have seen industrial humanity do out of this very same story, we are invited, I would say, by this story to nurture, to care for, even to sacrifice ourselves and our preferences to bring out the best of what can be brought out of all that God has made. I think the shape of the story itself carries that invitation. There's lots more we could say about that, but instead what I want to do this morning is add another layer to this. I want to make a connection, or begin to make a connection this morning, between those ideas and how we relate to one another around issues of gender. And just as a clarifier, gender is distinct from sexuality in this conversation, in my mind. In our culture, sexuality is increasingly understood quite simply as another choice in a range of choices. I heard a fascinating discussion with a guy who leads, and I can't remember the name of the association. I was in the car and I didn't write it down. But the guy who leads the association in North America for people who experience life as asexual beings. They don't have sexual feelings. They're just not there. And what's that like? Should it be in a manual of dysfunctions? Should it be diagnosable? Or is it another sexuality? It's fascinating. This is the world we live in. This is the world in which we have this conversation. And we ignore our setting at our peril. And we switch our imagination off about these issues at our peril. We do that, we're right back into the kind of behavior that reads subdue and fill the way that modern industrial humanity read. Not enough imagination. Liable to be a train wreck. It's not my way of answering the question, just saying if we don't do work on it, we're not doing the work we're made for. Gender is distinct from sexuality. Okay, it's another big topic, I know, and we'll take it on a little more another day, but I just want to open it up for us this morning and we can just let it churn for a while. Partly I want to do that because it falls naturally out of the text, male and female, were created by God. But also, partly because this is a week in which I've had a couple of absolutely heartbreaking conversations with women that have a significant history of being abused. And when I hear those stories and I think about how many relationships I'm aware of where the abusive behavior of the male is rooted in a misapplication of this same text, these same ideas of subdue and dominate being synonymous, I just get pissed. I just get mad. And I just don't want to be quiet about it. So, silence me another day. Today is my day. I do not believe, I cannot find it in me to believe that there is any justification for the abuse of relational, physical, sexual, or any other kind of power in the name of the God of Christendom. And without getting too far gone on the topic, I think we can easily see why that is so right here in the text that we've already read. Because in its simplest, most obvious form, verse 26 gives us the core reason why vertical power is not built into the gender structure of our world by God. And in case we missed it, this is what it says. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. Well, I think you have to do gymnastics with that text to turn it into vertical power structure. It feels so bonehead obvious to me. Maybe I'm the one that's being a bonehead, but when it comes to our image bearing, when it comes to our being made by God to be like God in so many ways, in the earliest telling of the story, in the earliest, most obvious, least nuanced text that we have about what it means to be human under the image of God, men and women equally bear the image of God. That's the least evolved statement we have about equality in the unfolding story of God and humanity. In other words, right from the beginning of the story, this is how it is. I might be preaching to the choir. If you feel yelled at, I apologize. Do we as genders bear different aspects of the image of God? Well, duh. Thank God. Yes, we do. And I don't think it's all that difficult to perceive that that's the case. How many different shapes that can take, that's another matter. We're not going to take it on now, but when it comes to working out the implications of this, we're right back into the realm of co-creation. We're right back into the realm where we get to figure out the details and where we're charged to do so in a way that is deeply consistent with the character and the intent of the inspirer of this big story that guides us. This is our gig. This is what we're made to do. And if we think of this text that way, then it's undeniable that one of the core intentions of our Maker is that men and women are equal. You go home and think about what that means for the transgendered person. You go home and think about what that means for the person who doesn't experience sexual feelings out of gender at all. Because if in fact Christ, whom God is like, came once for all, then there's nobody that's not on that list. Going. This is our job, you guys, is to work on this stuff. In the beginning, says the opening words of the story, and promptly, in a way that I've been making fun of the whole series because it's taken so long a time to travel so short a distance in the text, right up against that, we are introduced to humanity as gendered, and we are introduced to humanity in its genderedness, flooded with the dignity of equality by the story. What I want us to leave here with this morning is what I think is the strongest way of illustrating both the challenge and the beauty of what we're called to figure out when it comes to how we relate to one another as gendered beings under this idea. If we consider that this presentation of equality of men and women is the most straightforward and basic one in the Bible, And then as the story unfolds, we're going to encounter more and more nuanced or sophisticated or advanced ideas about this. Then it also follows that we should see some movement around this idea in the teaching of Christ, because Christ, as I just said a moment ago, and I'll remind us of it again, the radical truth of this, if we believe Jesus is God, is not that Jesus is like God, but that God is like Jesus. And so we come to Jesus and Jesus' life and teachings, his work in person, to look at and go, what does this tell us about who God is? So we read the story through that lens. So if we come to the teaching of Christ around these things, what does Jesus have to say about humans, how humans should relate to one another, particularly when it comes to matters of power? Because that's the framework we're in, right? That's essential to what we're talking about here, is how we will use the power that we have in every realm of co-rulership. John 13, which is becoming a favorite, pivotal text for me over the last couple of years as I've been thinking about these kind of things. I want to just read this to us, just one section, early on in the text, verse 2. The context is this: close to the end of Jesus' life, things are starting to go pretty sideways, and Jesus is having a meal with his disciples. And the evening meal, John tells us, was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So, he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Pay attention. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. Two things I want us to note here. First of all, there's a distinct similarity to the idea of Jesus having all things under his power and God's charge to all of humanity to rule over everything that was made, don't you think? The second thing I want us to notice is what Jesus does with his awareness of having all power. Because what he does, this is the word in our English text, so, because of this, Jesus got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist, poured a basin of water, and began to wash his disciples' feet. This is, for Jesus, the logical outworking of having all power. This is the so. If you have all power, this is what you do with it. If you're God. And if you're somebody who lives a life of imitation of God, this is what you do with it too. Because that's the mentor. That's the one that leads the way. That's the example we look to if we're trying to answer the question, how would God behave if he was here now? Having been given all power by the Father, this is what Jesus does. This is how God rules. Nothing like a despot. Nothing like a dictator. Anytime that we think that the idea of self-sacrifice or self-donation is the way of the weak, I would encourage us to give it a try. I don't think I need to expand on that. That's a pretty embodied test. Just go give it a go. It's not the realm of the weak. We will promptly discover that it is one of the most demanding, but also one of the most deeply right ways to live. Now, to bring this more specifically into the realm of gender, and I'll stay with the archetype, if you will, in Scripture of how husbands should love their wives. Ephesians, of course, Paul's teaching to this community that he cares for in Ephesus about this. In chapter 5, he writes to this community, he says, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. How the hell did we get from there to, woman, you need to be subject to me because God said so? And I'm not just swearing because I'm angry. It's a very deliberate choice of words. I just think that's the kind of twist that belongs with that language. In a typically upside-down kingdom kind of teaching, speaking to a male-dominated patriarchal culture in which women were often considered property, like I think I got me a fine horse here, the Bible tells men to use the power that culture says that they can legitimately use to power up over women, rather to serve. Having been given by my culture power over you, I strip myself of it, pick up my towel and my basin, and do the kind of nurturant living that needs to be done. That's the picture, people. Are we seeing this? Our imaginations being stirred by this at all? What do we do when we find ourselves with power within our grasp? Well, if we're going to walk in the way of Jesus, if we're going to follow the example, if we're going to operate in a way that is deeply consistent with the opening values of the big story that we live in and out of as people of God, then what we do with power when it's given to us is we voluntarily strip ourselves of it, and we work in our imagination and in our lived life to find some way to donate ourselves to the other. And the other, Genesis says from the outset, includes everything that God has made. That's who is my other. It's not even just other humans. Genesis is very clear about this. Birds, fish, everything that crawls on the ground. The whole shebang. Here's your power, people. Here's your marching orders. All of this is your responsibility. All of this is your charge. Rule this the way I would if I were you. What does it mean to rule over creation in a way that voluntarily divests power and takes on self-donation? How does that affect our preferences? How does that affect? What do we give up when we live like that? What does it mean to do business like that? What does it mean to raise children like that? What does it mean to get to work and back like that? This is the realm in which we live. And you know what? We don't need to be married to imagine the implications of this kind of one-downsmanship, as one of my mentors once called it, any more than Jesus had to be married to his disciples to find a way to express it. Vision for life in the Genesis text is so profoundly different than what has been made of it. Rather than plunder, the Genesis story tells us from the beginning, this is a story of unfolding nurturance. Rather than powering up, this is a story of empowering. Rather than a story of dominance, this is a story of self-donation. This is the story we live in, if we want to live in the story of God and humanity. I think that that's full of rich possibilities. But they're not the kind of possibilities that are going to be delivered fully formed to us, any more than creation was delivered that way to us. Why charge humanity with co-creation if the deal's all done? This is our work to do. And we're not done. Peace.